Support for Boston Public Radio comes from New England Recovery Center, providing inpatient addiction treatment in state-of-the-art facilities located in Westboro, Mass. All major insurance plans accepted. Learn more at newenglandrecoverycenter.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Is the Kool-Aid man guilty of aiding and abetting big tobacco? New research finds that cigarette makers applied their marketing magic to sugary drinks as a way to convert generations of kids into loyal customers. And speaking of loyalty, why do we bond with certain food brands? When it comes to mayonnaise, for example, we only buy Cane's when Hellman's freezes over. Joining us to talk about the, I am one of those kind of guys, actually. Joining us to talk about these headlines and more at the intersection of food policy and food culture is Corby Kummer. Corby is a senior editor at The Atlantic, an award-winning food writer, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy. Hello, Corby Kummer.
Well, hello there.
So this is another great story. I had no idea. Tell us how Big Tobacco got involved in selling Kool-Aid and Hawaiian Punch to little kids.
I think a chapter we forget in tobacco history is when the big tobacco was endangered and under attack, it started buying food companies. So Philip Morris owned Kraft, and it's already in the 1960s where they decided, hey, we have a lot of expertise in using cartoon characters, using swag like camping gear for Marlboro. We're going to apply that to kids. Plus, we've got a lot of flavors that we use in cigarettes. This predates vaping and Juul and cherry-flavored vaping. It was happening in cigarettes, and so the tobacco companies lent their advertising and marketing expertise and their cherry flavor and strawberry flavor that they already had to Hawaiian Punch and Kool-Aid and marketing cartoon characters.
God, I loved Hawaiian Punch, by the way. So on this note, I hesitate to tell these two stories, Corby, because maybe you haven't heard me tell them. Marjorie's heard them about 500 times, and she will note that she's heard them. One, the success of using cartoon characters till it was outlawed. There was a front page story in the Boston Globe, I don't know, a decade ago, saying that somewhere in the neighborhood of 93% of kids under blank, single digits, whatever it was, could identify Joe Camel. And it was a number that was greater than Mickey Mouse, meaning more people could identify Joe Camel smoking a cigarette than could identify Mickey Mouse. That was one. The second thing, this is the one she's really tired of. There was a New York Times, a Sunday magazine cover that was one of my favorite ever, which was a photograph of the tobacco executives, and it fits this discussion. I think they were testifying before Congress or some such thing, and the headline was, how do they live with themselves? And this is yet further reason. You know, we give people lung cancer, and we make every kid fat so they get horrible diseases. These people should be incarcerated.
Oh, let's come to their defense, Jim. You're surely being unfair. Now, this is before sugar was vilified. So what they were thinking was, we do want to hook kids. We want to hook them on these artificial flavors that don't really taste like anything. Everything is completely juiced up and beefed up with sugar, which is why you loved Kool-Aid.
Hawaiian Punch.
No, you loved Hawaiian Punch.
The original, thank you.
And the cartoon characters. Also because of the colors, you know, these lurid colors.
Yep.
But they wanted to deny. They were in denial about actually killing people, and nobody was raising the obesity card then. It wasn't part of the everyday discourse.
Well, by the way, if they weren't raising the obesity card, all they had to do was come to my house, and they would have seen that when you drink gallons of Pepsi and Hawaiian Punch every day, the likelihood is little Jimmy, as Marjorie would say, gets rolled to school by his mother in any case.
Okay, Corby Kummer, this next story's got me really worked into a frenzy.
Which one's this?
Because everything keeps changing. Just a little while ago, we heard that eggs weren't that bad for you, cholesterol-wise. And then we heard that we could go back to like whole milk and whole yogurt, which I immediately did. I went back to eggs. Now I hear that that's hooey, that cholesterol really does count and we shouldn't be eating too many eggs. I don't know what the truth is with whole milk, which I've turned back to, and whole milk yogurt, too.
So in the annals of nutrition confusion, which is something I'm working to combat in my role at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science and Policy.
Policy, yes.
This is going to go down in the annals because it is one of those, for decades we were told, do not eat eggs, do not eat dietary cholesterol, it will raise your cholesterol. There were a lot of doubts about how much does dietary cholesterol, the stuff you take in your mouth, actually raise the level of serum cholesterol, the cholesterol in your blood. This came under question, and then by the time the dietary guidelines of 2015 to 2020, they said you should eat as little cholesterol as possible while consuming a healthy eating pattern. But the scientific report that went with those guidelines said cholesterol is not a nutrient of concern for overconsumption, suggesting that Marjorie could go back to eating as many eggs and cream as she wanted.
Right.
But now, today, there's a report of a new meta-study. So meta-surveys can often be manipulated by the authors. It means taking hundreds and hundreds of surveys from different data sources, because the accusations are the researchers will go in with a finding they want to find, they'll manipulate the data and add up all the studies that will give them the result they want. But in this one, that overcame a lot of the usual problems of these meta-surveys, in that evidently the researchers were able to pinpoint person by person the effect of eggs. This was about eggs on their cholesterol levels. Now, it was self-reported, which means that people lie about what they eat, so it was less reliable than usual, but the specificity of the data person by person, very unusual in a big survey like this. And what did it say? It said that there's a 17% increased risk of heart disease and 18% of premature death for each additional 300 milligrams of day of cholesterol in the diet. Cholesterol is all in the yolk. So when we're talking about eggs, it's all in the yolk. You're okay with egg whites.
Well, and what did we discuss last week on this show?
Your favorite breakfast.
Is my, not my favorite breakfast, the breakfast I eat every day, because we were discussing with Corby, when you eat the same thing every day, is I eat an egg white omelet. And problem solved, right? There's zero cholesterol in the egg white. And frankly, for those who haven't tried it, it doesn't really taste any different.
It's the yolk that tastes
good. No, not when you, not in an omelet when you have other stuff in it, kind of other kinds of things. You know what you do to be safe is you make sure you load up the egg white omelet with a lot of processed meat and sausages and stuff like that. So you don't even mind that there's no yolk. And
that's right. American
Kraft
slices.
Single slices.
Kraft singles, which individual are in 40% of American
so,
kitchens.
So, Corby, before we leave this.
Eggs are out.
Marjorie said, you know, back forth.
No, yolks are out.
I mean, it's pretty, I put great credence in this thing that yolks are a problem and you should try to live with the egg white, which Marjorie can't do and which I can. I mean, this should be the final word, I think. Is it or what?
Boy, it's never really a final word, because the final word a few years ago was that dietary cholesterol barely affected serum cholesterol, so you didn't have to worry about it. I don't know, but I really, my eyes were very wide when I read this, because I thought this is bad for the nutrition and food writing business, because it just looks confusing.
And one, and we don't know, or maybe we do know, because of the increased amount of cholesterol that you ingest supposedly can affect your heart disease risk.
Huge.
What about, should we go back? Should we forget about the whole milk and the whole yogurt that fills you up and go back to 2%?
Well, you're in luck, Marjorie, because this study focused on eggs.
Just eggs.
And egg yolks.
Okay.
And Jim, I have not told you, I join your merry band. I had an office worker who said about a wonderful young colleague who said recently, when I was maybe making a mild criticism of something to do with their eating habits, she said, at least you don't have to watch me eat your CVS hard-boiled eggs like we have to watch you. So I buy packets of hard-boiled eggs, or I get them from the place across the street in the World Wildlife Fund building, and I carefully remove all the yolks, and this is what grossed out all of my colleagues.
Now, do you think, by the way, in light of what's dangerous, do you think I should read anything into the fact that Marjorie's Christmas present to me this year was the Sausage of the Month Club, and every once a month, sitting at my desk upstairs, I get a pack of sausages to go home and shove in my pie hole? Do you think that's...
I would say it was loving and tender concern.
Oh, that is.
It was.
It really is.
Well, that's because the year before I gave him the Salami of the Month Club, and he told me it was the best...
Two of the best gifts I've ever gotten in my life.
Exactly. So I don't know what I can do to top that.
Look,
the
I don't think there are any egg yolks in it.
That's exactly right. We're talking to Corby Kummer, our food guy.
Okay, so now we have Meatless Mondays in the New York City schools. Bill de Blasio thinks this is a good idea for...
But you can't eat eggs, so what are you going to eat at the Meatless Monday?
I guess you have to have beans. I don't know what you have. Maybe you have peanut butter. But in any case, it's for health-wise and planet climate change-wise.
Good for him.
Yeah. What do you think, Corby?
So there's been an international movement toward Meatless Mondays for years. Of course, it originated in the Netherlands.
Of course.
And there's this great Mondag. There's this great way of saying Meatless Monday. It's also alliterative there. But Bill de Blasio did a pilot program in 15 schools last spring. And next year, 2019 to 2020, across New York Public Schools, it's going to be Meatless Mondays for breakfast and lunch. Now, I don't know how much meat there is in the daily diet. Of course, whenever there have been campaigns like this, the USDA, which is the kind of mouthpiece for the Department of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, says this is unfair. It's imposing something wrong. It's an extremist animal rights campaign. What it is all environmental. It's to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but it's what it's really to do is to give students an example and form this habit young. I think it's great, and I think that teachers can incorporate this into science curriculums, the ecosphere, the biosphere. I think it's setting an example, and that's the great symbolic significance of it.
And, you know, if you're looking for alliteration, you mentioned Meatless Monday. You know what my favorite alliteration is? Sausage Saturday. It goes right with it. Okay, forget that.
Yeah, we have to think of thanks to Marjorie.
Exactly.
Yes, I think it's a great
idea. Or Salami
idea.
Sunday.
They're very high-quality salamis
they are
and
really,
sausages, you said.
Really,
yeah, it's
really
very expensive
good.
Gift. You might really
so,
open up the pocketbook.
I mentioned in the introduction of this thing, this brand loyalty thing. There was it in the New York Times who read the story? But there was
the Globe.
Story. You know, I am totally this. I eat... One of my favorite foods is corned beef hash, and I love corned beef hash fresh. It's really great at a bunch of places in town. But every time I have an urge and think back to my childhood, I go buy the same crap I ate when I was a little boy. Corned beef hash and a can, Broadcast corned beef hash. And if there's like five different brands on the shelf and there's not Broadcast, I won't even eat it. And it's because of this brand loyalty thing. What's the genesis of this? Just nostalgia, or what is it?
It's the same people who sold us Joe Camel, tobacco, and got you hooked on Hawaiian Punch. It's the same marketing muscle. To an extent, in this case, it's what did your parents buy and what did you find yourself in the pantry in your own house? So nostalgia has something to do with it. But it's also habits. You were talking earlier at the top of the segment about Hellman's mayonnaise,
sure,
or diehard Hellman's mayonnaise. But that is because there are distinct flavor profiles in the amount of vinegar, the amount of salt. It really changes by brand. I doubt the corned beef hash really changes. And I think that's a case of nostalgia, unlike the sugar, which was just getting you hooked on artificial colors and sugar in Hawaiian Punch.
You know, they talk in the story about a kind of mayonnaise I'd never heard of, Duke's mayonnaise.
Oh, we've discussed this on the air. Some people have called our show when we've had food discussions and said the only mayonnaise, that's the only reason I ever heard of it. The only mayonnaise they'll eat is Duke's. They have their relative send it to them, or maybe it's on Amazon or something.
Have you ever had it? Is there something really different about it, Corby?
I have had it, and what I remember with all of these is it's the sharpness of the vinegar.
Okay.
It's the vinegar that makes all the difference, and the salt level. But, you know, it's also like QP mayonnaise, K-E-W-P-I-E, which is Japanese and uses hot chilies and is part of many people's favorite sushi rolls. You know, they love QP mayonnaise, they can't do without this, or sriracha hot sauce. People become addicted to a certain flavor combination. They associate it with either their favorite restaurants or why did you love that corned beef hash? And why wasn't it Dinty Moore's? That's what I said.
I forgot Dinty Moore beef stew.
Dinty Moore beef stew.
Wait, you know, but that's really interesting. No, not only did I only eat Dinty making more beef stew. If, for those who didn't eat it when they were a kid, it is almost inedible. It's like the meat has grizzle on it.
Oh, I would say for those who did eat it as a kid.
So did either of you two have a brand of any kind of food that you've stayed loyal to all these years?
Actually, I've changed. I used to be into Cane's mayonnaise because it was all natural, but I switched to the mayonnaise that you, Omega that you get at Whole Foods.
And how about you,
and
Corbin?
You know what I've switched?
What?
I love peanut butter. It's one of my favorite foods, as you know, and I ate Skippy peanut butter for years, but I've gone now to the natural ones, the Smuckers or the Teddy's or the 365, and now I can't go back to Skippy. It tastes cardboardy or something.
Do you have a brand loyalty thing?
I was about to talk about peanut butter. Like mayonnaise, it has very different flavor profiles depending on the sugar content mostly, and also the smoothness or whether it's homogenized and so it's made very spreadable or whether it's chunky. So there are actual differences there. Mine is Marshmallow Fluff, the great brand from, is it Lynn or Somerville?
Somerville.
It's Somerville.
I think it moved to Lynn.
Oh, it
did? And the Fluff Festival, or whatever it's called, is in Somerville every year, isn't it?
Yeah, the Fluffernutter sandwich, peanut butter and marshmallow fluff.
But it was only good because of the marshmallow fluff.
Yeah, I have no idea why this reminds me. Every time I go to a restaurant and have an incredible meal, I just realize I think of you, Corby. Yeah, before we move to the next topic. No, I'm serious because I want to get your sense on it. I've eaten there before, but I eat at Puritan Company in Inman Square Saturday night. Will Gilson's, the chef, owner, whatever. It's one of the best meals. Have you been there recently?
I have not been there recently, and I'm really glad that Will Gilson, who started selling herbs with his father at the farmer's market on City Hall Plaza when he was a teenager, and his father would tell everybody, you have to have my son's cooking, and he sort of bounced around several Cambridge kitchens, and it's remarkable what he's done. The Globe recently, it was the Globe that did that brand loyalty, it was Kara Baskin's story.
Right.
The Globe recently did something about how Will Gilson has kept his clients loyal by understanding what they eat. And when he began, I think he was much more rooted in a kind of trying to do historical New England cuisine.
Yeah.
And then he moved to what his clients wanted. He was sensitive and shrewd about adjusting the menu to what was popular. And he's a good businessman.
It was one of the best meals I've had in ages, so I thought of you. We're talking to Corby Cummer. So, Corby, I always am wondering, because I believe my government should keep me safe, when it turns out there are rubber chunks and plastic pieces in my meat, I expect my government to do something about it. Is that an unreasonable expectation?
Don't forget the glass fragments.
Oh, and glass fragments. I forgot glass fragments. What about?
They've got you covered. The USDA recently released a draft handbook to help meat companies deal with this awful situation that's been happening, which is rubber in chicken, plastic, wood chips. In January alone, Purdue recalled more than 68,000 pounds of chicken nuggets after consumers complained of having found wood in them. So this is a really interesting story about the more than doubling in these foreign contaminants in food causing recalls. There were 6 foreign matter recalls, as they're called, in 2014, 12 the next year, 2015, but there were 25 in 2017. It's been doubling.
Now, this may be naive, but I don't understand the industry like you do. When you order meat, can you say, I would like it without rubber chunks and glass fragments? Or do you not?
I'd actually like to specify it because I think wood is good fiber. No, I don't understand. One thing that this story doesn't talk about is this really a case of there's stricter inspection now, and so they're finding more
good
of these. The way whenever you find, of course it's good, but when you find a sharp uptick in a disease, you wonder, is it because reporting is better and they have found it? Just to speculate, a lot of so-called co-packers, there's lots of satellite industries that actually prepare the food for a food company. They're subcontractors, and they're the ones who are often putting the rubber chunks and the wood in. And so what it suggests is there has to be much closer coordination between the parent company and the co-packers they're contracting to.
Okay, Corby Cummer, this is a story by National Public Radio, so of course it has to be true, but I'm a little confused by the whole thing.
Not me.
The invention of processed foods, basically yogurt, gruel, thousands of years ago, gave us the F word and many other F words. Can you explain the story, please?
So this is the weirdest story. I mean, is the strange story of the week, which is that once hunter-gatherers didn't have to really chew on their nuts and berries and meat and wood stems for nutrition, and agriculture came in, and they started having yogurt. And by the way, yogurt, before it was a fad food, was a way of warding off spoilage in milk and keeping and being able to travel with it. You know, fermenting food will keep it from becoming lethal and having pathogens. So the changes in natural overbite allowed man to start making the F sound and the V sound. And so a whole lot of words with the F and V sounds evolved and entered the language, thanks to, as the NPR story said, newly pampered humans.
Why do you find that so odd, the two of you?
I don't know. I just do.
Well, I assume based upon my use of the F word, I must be eating more yogurt than you are. Is the only thing I can.
I think, Jim, it's only because you're quite as fond of the labiodental fricative.
Exactly.
As,
yeah, I am. Always have been. Always will be.
And it maintains supposedly the because your teeth weren't worn down so much, you maintain the natural overbite.
Mm-hmm.
Enabling you to say these words.
I've said that many times before.
Okay. Right.
Hey, Corby, great to talk to you as always. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Corby Kummer joins us every week. Thank you, Corby. Corby is a senior editor at The Atlantic, an award-winning food writer, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy. Thanks again. Up next, we're opening the lines and asking you about President Trump's response to the New Zealand shootings. That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.